Okay, well, listen, first of all, I want to thank everyone for joining in here. I'm honored that you're all working with my material so creatively. So what I thought would be the best way to go about this was to start off with me describing a little bit about what I've been thinking about over the past couple of years, the kind of work that I'm doing, and then I wanted to actually hand it over for a few minutes to Luke and his team to describe what they're doing at Trinity Valley, which I think is very exciting. And I'll give the context for it now. So some of you may know this, some of you may not. The ways that I've been developing this material over recent years has been in three core fields. For one thing, I run a consulting business training elite mental performers. And it's very interesting deep dive work with people who are on the edge of being world class or who are already world class, just taking them over that hump. And it's extremely interesting creative work. I also own a martial arts school in New York City with Marcelo Garcia, who's the 9-time Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion. And we have a squad of 330 really tough competitors. So these are people who are at the cutting edge of the physical performance world. And, of course, the foundation work working with teachers, students, parents. And so these three arenas are a fascinating way for me to dive into deeper and deeper into the integration of these principles, the development of these principles. And what I find myself coming to consistently are thematics and habit creation. This has been where I've been focusing over the last couple of years. On the thematic side, I'm speaking about developing the ability of individuals and classes to find connections that others are missing. As you guys know, a core part of my process was the translation of my ideas from chess to the martial arts, from a mental to a physical discipline. And ultimately, I had this experience of the walls breaking down between these arts, and they became one in my mind. And then I took on a third art, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and it was a similar kind of experience. And working with people who were at the cutting edge of different mental arenas, the creativity is at the core of what I do, helping people develop routines, habits to take their creativity to another level, so idea generation. And this is really systematically cultivating the art of, again, breaking down walls between different components of life. People tend to focus on having an informational advantage, but one thing that I keep on coming back to and seeing reinforced over and over is that it's usually not the informational edge so much as what you do with information that a lot of people have, ways of putting together material in ways that other people weren't able to put it together before. It's a very simple idea, but it has extremely complex and dramatic outcome if you really cultivate it at a high level. And of course, the point is that these principles, and this gets to some questions that you guys sent me, the principles, teaching them intellectually is one thing, but helping students integrate them into their lives is another, and that's where habit creation comes in. And I think a very interesting way for us to go about this call is to discuss how to create classroom experiences which nurture in children the abilities to find connections that other people are missing, nurture their creativity. For example, one thing that I love that Luke and his team are doing at Trinity Valley and this is where I envision my foundation going increasingly, is having a cross-disciplinary exploration of a given principle. So for example, teachers in a number of different subjects will be teaching their material, but also teaching a certain principle of learning, of resilience, of creativity. And so the students are seeing the same principle manifest in different fields and are learning to make those kinds of connections on their own. When I think about combining that with really teaching students how to integrate habits that will drive these abilities deeper, that's the direction I think would be very exciting for all of us to explore. And with that sort of philosophical framing, I'd love to hand it over for the moment to Luke Jacob, who is doing such wonderful work at Trinity Valley, and he has some of his team on the line as well. And they'll spend a few minutes describing what they've done so far and what they have in mind, and then I'll take over from where Luke leaves off with his plan for his 9th grade students and discuss how we can integrate habit creation into all of this. Luke, do you want to take it away for a few minutes?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. I appreciate it. I'm here with Dr. Gary Cron, our head of school, Chris Gunnan, our head of upper school, and Leslie Garcia of our 2nd grade team, who will talk a little bit about the specifics at that grade level. Really quick backstory. the way we started all of this at TVS is that a couple of years ago, we offered anyone who wanted a chance to read Josh's book, a copy of the book. And we had 50, 60 people read the book, and we began conversations about principles that were cross-divisional and cross-departmental. And we spent a few months thinking in those ways and having conversations that didn't have boundaries until we made them. And eventually what came out of it was a set of people who were willing to volunteer to start integrating principles into classroom practice with questions much like what Ken, I believe, sent to you about, well, what does that mean to take these abstractions and to integrate them? And so the grade levels at which most of this work has been done so far have been grades 2 and 8 here at Trinity Valley School. The 8th grade teacher who really started the project in the middle school is now working with 7th grade. She would be here with us were she not out sick today, but I think we can do okay with what she's done and what she's doing without her. But the most advanced interdisciplinary work that has developed in the last 2 years at Trinity Valley is in grade 2, where Leslie Garcia, who is here with us, started off working with the principle of making smaller circles with her students. And it went so well that the next year, the visual arts teacher, Melissa Black, and the computer and technology instructor, you know, the computer sciences teacher, Karen Arrington, both began also teaching that principle. And the three of them approached the same way, very different things with their kids. So for a moment, I'm going to just let Leslie, who's here with us, talk about, you know, give you a 2 to 3 minute synopsis of grade 2 on behalf of herself and Karen and Melissa.
Leslie, this is Josh. Quickly, thank you so much for the beautiful work you do. I've been hearing about it, and I'm really excited to hear some more right now.
Well, thank you, and I really appreciate your ideas. And as Luke said, we were invited to read your book and then define and funnel it down to what spoke to us and incorporate it in our teaching. And making small circles was, I got smaller and smaller, and that's where I hovered. And I remember a book written many years ago called Small is Beautiful, and love that title. And I think it fits, really does fit, with the elementary student, and especially the second grade student, 7 going on 8. The first year that I used it, I've always taught a lesson on Pourquoi stories, and then using making smaller circles just seemed to be a natural fit for exploring those stories in a different way. And these animal parts, these small parts, and what an animal did in their life ultimately defined what they became. And so that seemed like a good springboard to start teaching making smaller circles. Then the second year, Melissa and Karen joined in. And Karen was using a Peter Reynolds book called The Dot, where a child can't draw, but they can, at least the art teacher said, well, everybody can make a dot. And from that little dot of paint, then the child created other artwork, and just signing their name made them feel important. So that was used. But going back to the Pourquoi stories, the way we teamed on that particular unit was that Melissa Black had the children focus by using a little picture frame, very small, maybe 3 by 3 inches, on a large picture, say, of a rhinoceros, how the rhino got his skin, being one of the stories we study. And then they focused just on that one part and created an art piece for just that part. And then an e-book was published and Karen Arrington facilitated in that. And the narrative on the ebook was taken from what they'd done in my classroom, which was what was the problem in the story, what was the change in the story, and then what was the outcome. And so the whole story was funneled down to a smaller and smaller description.
Great. And if I may, then I will kind of expand that, thank you so much, Leslie, to how that's done in the middle school, because Tina has used the same principle of making smaller circles with eighth graders, where, of course, the conversations can be more abstract for obvious reasons. She was approaching the really giant concept of tragedy, introducing kids to the structure of classical tragedy, Shakespearean tragedy, and ways in which you might see tragic story structures in the modern world. And she used making smaller circles in both kind of micro and macro ways to say, well, let's focus in really hard on one aspect of tragedy. Don't try to master the whole thing. Let's just talk about hubris and what that is, and let's master that before we even think about what the larger thing is. And then she would zoom back out and talk about how it fit in the larger process. And then she'd zoom back in on something else and out. And that's the work that she's taking to grade 7. And in grade 9, and I'm going to let Josh talk about this a bit. He and I were just discussing this yesterday. I was looking at doing some work with beginner's mind with grade 9, taking advantage of the fact that writing essays and the way that we do this feels to the kids like learning a brand new art from scratch. And Josh pointed out that when it comes to habit creation, the phrase he's been using, using some of the students' writing, daily writing work, could turn their studies not just into the beginner's mind way of looking at things, but we could take advantage of numbers to leave numbers. And Josh, would you like to, since this was generative from your thoughts yesterday, would you like to talk a little bit about what you kind of started envisioning about how we could use high schoolers' newness to certain things to our advantage?
Sure, Luke. So Luke was describing a core principle of this ninth grade course he's going to be teaching as being the exploration of structure. And structure, of course, is integral to the foundation of every discipline. But at a high level, often you find artists who are able to integrate structure so deeply into their being that they leave it behind. And this principle is one that I have called numbers to leave numbers or form to leave form. And you guys are familiar with this from my book. But essentially, if you think about, for example, the greatest abstract expressionist painters or sculptors, their realist skills are often usually at a very high level. Someone like Jackson Pollock was extraordinary as a realist drawer and painter, illustrator. But you know what he's known for is his magnificent abstraction. Similar with great basketball players, for example, who internalize a body mechanics so deeply that then they're able to shoot at a very high level when they're off balance and it looks like their body mechanics are out the window. Chess players who integrate principles, for example, like controlling the center, which are foundational principles, so deeply into their being that ultimately they're able to control the center without playing in the center at all. And so the amateur mind from the outside would look at it and not see any central control, but they've integrated these principles so deeply that they're able to manifest them without them being manifested literally. So this idea of numbers to leave numbers, form to leave form, a lot of what this relates to is the creative process, the generation of insight, that crystallization experience where you study complex material and it's gelled by the unconscious mind or into the intuition into a relatively simple feeling or an insight. And there are artists who have explored this and ways of building daily routines, habits around this for so long. Hemingway has written about it very beautifully. He describes these two principles of the creative process, one being he would always end his work day with something left to write. So people usually feel guilty if they don't do everything they can possibly do in a given day. But he'd wake up in the morning with a certain amount in mind, a certain amount of a story to write, and he would stop before he'd written it all. And then his second principle was to stop thinking about it, which is also a little bit counterintuitive, as opposed to planning everything out, being excessive, just constantly thinking about it. He would release his mind in the evening, wake up in the morning, and that morsel will turn into something very large, and he'd pour it all out of him again. I've had discussions along these lines with some of the greatest athletes in the world. For example, Billy Kidd, the great skier, described the three most important turns of the ski run being the last three before you get in the lift, which is very counterintuitive, again, because most skiers are sloppiest then. They take their weight off the muscles they've been using. The slope is leveled off. It's very easy. And so they're sloppy. They get in the lift. They ride the lift up, and what they internalize and lift right up is sloppiness. What Billy speaks about, and he's one of the greatest downhill Olympic racers in history, for those of you who don't know, is the idea of, in the position of reduced complexity, the bottom of the hill, having extremely refined body mechanics, and then that's what gets internalized deep into the muscle memory on the lift ride up, and then you've learned the lesson. This is something I integrate into my martial arts school. Almost all schools will tend to have the structure of you begin with a warm-up, then you do technique work, then you do sparring. So beginners then are ending their workout sloppy, exhausted. They're like kind of like wet noodles. And the last thing you're doing before they leave is sloppy work. So then they internalize sloppiness overnight. We have everyone stop, get a drink of water, and then the last 3 minutes do drilling, a very simple technique, precise body mechanics. So what they take home is this thing they've done at a very high level. And it's feeding the unconscious in the creative process. And so what I was suggesting to Luke is that while he's talking about structure and he's exploring the idea of form to leave form, numbers to leave numbers, and he could do this by studying the creative process or the insights generated by great mathematicians, scientists, artists, anything, he could then also have the students begin to integrate the habit of closing their work day, their homework session or their work session at school, by focusing on an area of complexity and then releasing the mind and then waking up first thing in the morning and journaling about it. And if they were to do this over 3 or 4 weeks, this would be a form of homework that wouldn't just be what I would call local or something which is limited. It would be something which would help them internalize a journaling process which taps this creative rhythm of studying complexity, taking a break, and then coming up with an insight from that complexity, which is the kind of rhythm that most of the greatest ideas in the history of humanity have come from. And it's a way of both studying the idea, structure, numbers to leave numbers, form to leave form, intellectually, developing a habit around it, and really integrating it into their life, into their kinesthetic being, and also learning something that they can continue to do for the rest of their lives. So, for example, if they're studying for tests, if they are studying complex material that they need to integrate into an insight, if they're trying to learn a body mechanic while they're, you know, playing a certain sport. This rhythm is such a high-level rhythm. And it's a way of integrating habit creation into the structure of a classroom. And you know, this ties into something I thought of a moment ago while I was hearing you speak. You know, Luke, you were speaking about the idea of making smaller circles, and I often use the language of learning the macro from the micro for what you're describing. So, for example, studying, again, in chess, the way this manifests is that studying the end game first, or often studying the most simple position possible in the end game in chess, which is king and pawn against king. And by studying that position of reduced complexity, you learn certain principles, but those principles can be applied to the most complicated areas of the chess game. And most people make the mistake of studying the openings first, where things are incredibly complex. They have to memorize so much, all the pieces are on the board, but they're overwhelmed by tactical complexity and they can't get to the deeper principles. By studying the micro first, or in the positions of reduced complexity, they can learn the principles in sports, the body mechanics, which can then be applied to the most complex scenarios. So a way that you could tie this kind of thing in, again, in a cross-disciplinary manner, is that at your schools, if you're working on a principle like making smaller circles or learning the macro from the micro, you could bring in, for example, the phys ed teacher or a coach of a given sport. The learning of body mechanics at both a beginning level and at a world-class level in any physical discipline should be done this way. You want to study the body mechanics. You don't want to just shoot a basketball. You want to work on a small piece of the form of shooting a basketball. Same thing with dribbling a soccer ball or dribbling a basketball or throwing a football or learning how to do something in the martial arts. You work on a small piece of it, you refine it, and you touch quality, then you expand from that feeling of quality and from that good body mechanics. So this is the way that I think it would be very exciting for teachers, for principals, for people running school systems to think about this stuff, working with principals and then getting it into an increasingly cross-disciplinary exploration. And Luke and Gary. Gary, it's a pleasure. I haven't touched base with you in a couple of years. I'm really glad you've joined. This is the kind of thing that would be very powerful for you guys to consider when you're exploring this making smaller circles, learning the macro from the micro, is to work on the physical manifestation of it. One thing that I find consistently with when I train people who are at the top ends of different mental arenas is that the physical harnessing of the principle can often help unbelievably with the integration of the mental principle. So, for example, if you're trying to teach someone to release the mind, if we're working on stress and recovery, and releasing the mind is a big part of this numbers leave numbers process and this journaling process, posing a question end of day, releasing the mind, then tapping it first thing in the morning, pre-input and starting to brainstorm on it. If they're trying to integrate the ability to turn it on and turn it off, teaching them to do stress and recovery workouts, where they're moving their heart rate, for example, if it's an adult, somewhere between 170 and 144. When their ability to turn it on and turn it off physically comes, their ability to turn on and off mentally tends to follow. And so I think it's very interesting to work on physical manifestations of these principles with your sports teams or your phys ed teachers while you're working on these principles in the classroom.
And Josh, if I could really quick throw in one thing about what you've just said, and then we'll turn over to your structure for everybody else. It's worth noting for anyone who works in a school that this kind of conversation, you know, the first bit of nervousness is often we're talking a process, we're not talking content, we're not talking product, we're talking curriculum in a very different way. It's worth knowing that there are very straightforward structural things that can be done, that Leslie and her colleagues, for instance, send home a note to parents that says very explicitly, you know, in the next little while, your children may be walking around making smaller circles in the backyard and trying to focus in on a few blades of grass or looking at carpet fibers through, you know, a paper towel roll. And it's not, this is why we're doing this. We're asking them to look at things in a different way. You know, similarly, what Josh and I have been talking about for ninth grade, I'm going to try to work into something experimental I did this last semester for the first time, which is a three-week period at the beginning of the semester where I didn't give any letter grades on anything to any student in the ninth grade, to sort of get them thinking, focus of what we're really doing, which is a process. It's not the end goal here is to really get the process down and to understand it. And teachers in all grade levels, I'm talking high school, Leslie's talking lower school, can just take advantage of straightforward communication about the goals, about the fact that we're trying to create process. And people tend to get that, I think, pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, Luke, just to build on this, I'd like to make two points. First of all, this idea of thematic communication with parents, I think, is so underdeveloped in the educational system in general. It breaks my heart. Even some of the most progressive educational movements are lacking on this front. And so you'll have students who are, if you think about, for example, the basic Carol Dweck material of fixed versus entity versus incremental theories of intelligence, in terms of a fixed view of intelligence versus one which is more mastery-oriented, more resilient, understanding that the road to excellence is defined by process as opposed to an ingrained level of ability. You'll have teachers who know about this material, and the students are making beautiful progress in the classroom, but they don't communicate it to the parents, and so the students are making two steps forward in the classroom and three steps back at home. And around this kind of thematic discussion, the simple step of taking a page, an email or a printout, and sending it to parents about what you're working on thematically, the parents can often want to be creatively involved in the educational process. They just don't know what's going on. And I think that around specific subject matter, sometimes this happens, but around the themes, the broader principles, it's so incredibly important. And I mean, all of you, I highly encourage you to do this. I think it can have an exponential impact on the speed of integration of these ideas for the students. And, you know, and one more thing, you know, this process over outcome discussion is so huge. And, you know, Luke mentioned it relative to withholding grades, which I personally think is a beautiful thing. Of course, that's a very difficult thing to do in much of the educational system. But I think, you know, a number of the questions that you guys emailed me were around how to really help students integrate this stuff, how to help it not only manifest in the classroom but manifest in their lives. And I think that one way to explore this is through this broader theme of resilience. one thing that I see consistently with my own son, with kids I've worked with my whole life as a teacher, as a chess teacher, when I was a young man, and then working with kids in classrooms, is that they focus much more on what you do so often than what you say. And so if a teacher or a parent speaks about an incremental theory of intelligence or about process mattering over outcome, but they don't live it, they don't embody it, the students will see the difference. And so I think that one of the most important things to go through working with this material is to really wrestle with these principles on one's own. We've developed these guides, a teacher guide, a student guide, and a parent guide to all of the material that the foundation works with. And those of you who haven't already, you know, grappling with this material yourself, it can be a very interesting process because it can help come up with really organic ways of working on it with students. And it can help you make sure that you're not losing touch with these principles yourself. Like, for example, there's so many things in learning, I think, which there are so many different approaches. There are some things, though, which we've seen consistently enough are somewhat hierarchical, like this process over outcome discussion. It's just so critical for students to develop a resilient, flexible vision of the long-term path to mastery. And there are things that we can do in the classroom to make the classroom breathe of process over outcome orientation. The way we even if we have to give tests, we have to give grades, the way we frame them, the way we discuss them, the kinds of intuitive feedback we give to students, relaying this to parents and teaching them how to relate to kids this way. I think that these are the kinds of things, again, these are habits that one can create and one can help students create to really internalize these principles very, very deeply. I'm going to open up for some questions. I know a lot of you have questions, but I do think that we should all think creatively about this theme of habit creation, how we can tie habits into the curriculum as we work with these principles. And Katie on my team is really brilliant. She's a wonderful classroom teacher and a really creative mind, and she and I work together very closely. So whenever you have questions specifically about how to integrate certain principles that you're curious about or that you think would be rich for your students into the classroom, both in terms of curriculum, in terms of homework assignments, in terms of discussion topics, but also in terms of habits that they might internalize to help them internalize it deeper, the principles more deeply, please reach out to Katie, and you know she'll have a lot of ideas, and she and I can discuss them and get back to you. I really hope that you tap the resources of the foundation in a rich, dynamic way, because we can do really special things together. So that said, let me toss out there, so I know some of you have questions. Who would like to launch?
Hi, this is Annie, and I'm the head of an English department in a bilingual school that goes from pre-kinder to 11th grade. I'm in Bogota, Colombia. And,
wonderful, hi, Annie. I've heard great things about you.
Thanks, Josh. It's been great to read your book, and I haven't figured yet how to get things into the mm-hmm. school and into the classroom, so this is great for me. But I wanted to comment on what you guys were just saying right now. You're giving me such amazing ideas, and I just wanted to give some feedback. I don't have a specific question. But I'm in a school that really values the idea of discipline and values, to put it in those terms. And what I'm hearing is the idea of shifting this notion of discipline to the idea of habits, because I think that's really what we're talking about. We're trying to move away from being a punitive kind of a community to really having students understand what it means to have values, but what are those values? So that was one idea that came into place as I was listening. The other things I wanted to share with you, when you're talking about small is beautiful and smaller circles, I received an amazing resource from a webpage called Partners in Place, and this is a group in Madison, Wisconsin. And it's to teach observation skills, and really it kind of has a focus on science. But imagine just a circle, and each child has the opportunity to design their circle over time. But imagine the idea that you take the same window and the same time every day, and for 5 minutes you look out the window and you try to document what you see and what changes from one day to the next or from one season to the next. And it's a really gorgeous way, I've never used it, but it's a beautiful way of just teaching young children to observe the same thing and see what's different over time. So I was just looking, that's called partnersinplace.com, and you can download the circles and see those things. But that was something else I wanted to say. Then I'm also just thinking about what I've seen, the balance between intellectual work and physical work. In our school, we're highly intellectual, and we're struggling a lot to just have children move in the classroom, not only in PE class. So I wanted to say, Josh is talking about bringing the PE teacher in, but I think we need to look at how we're moving with teachers themselves and having them be willing to move desks around. It sounds like we're in such an old school. Move desks around and have children jump and have them interact with things, because we have not been able to accomplish that. And finally, that kind of leads me to the question of how do we work first with teachers? I'm not in the classroom very much. I'm more with a group of teachers, and I need to see how to have them experience these things first before I can ask them to experience things in the classroom with their students.
Okay. You brought up so many fascinating points. I love what you've said. Okay, so let me just respond to a few of them. First of all, in terms of the last thing you said, a very good starting point is to touch base with Katie, if she hasn't already, she could send to you the teacher guide to our material. And this is specifically designed to do what you said, which is basically have teachers grapple with these principles and really work on them, on integrating them themselves. So we've taken on that question very seriously for a number of years, and so we've got the response to that one already set up. In terms of the movement in the classroom, you know, these principles of integrating body mechanics through working with the most simple body mechanic first and expanding from it, it's counterintuitive for a lot of people because everyone wants to work on the fancy stuff first, but it's foundational to almost any skill you can learn. And so whether it's learning how to walk, learning how to use a pencil, learning how to jump, learning how to run, learning how to do a discipline like Tai Chi or yoga or meditate, anything. I think that you could work creative, as long as you have someone who knows that discipline well, whatever it is, that skill well, they could harness that principle. So I think that there's unbelievable ways you can do it. And again, you know, if you describe your specific constraints to Katie, she can work with you creatively on skills that might be very interesting for students to learn, both in terms of the specific skill, but also what they can learn from the learning of that skill.
Exactly.
Please do that. Okay. Be closely in touch with Katie, and she and I will think about this creatively, and we can build this together. It could be very exciting. In terms of the first thing you said, which was very interesting, you spoke about discipline and how this connects to habit creation, and you spoke about a punitive culture, moving it towards a more positively inspiring culture. You know, I think that the research around toward versus away motivation, around intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, around developing a student's internal passion for learning versus have them be more externally oriented relative to tests or shame or external pressures. There's so much research out there, and there's so much practice out there, and it goes without saying that we want to create cultures in our classrooms, in our schools, in our corporations, in everything, that are defined by toward motivation, students working towards something as opposed to moving away from something that they're afraid of, who are intrinsically motivated by a love for the learning process as opposed to by external constraints or external fears or pressures. So the way that we frame why students are doing things is so important. And, of course, it's a huge challenge in classrooms where so many teachers are operating within the constraints of standardized tests the students absolutely must make, must be prepared for. But in the most constrained of environments or difficult environments for this, it can still be done. I mean, I grew up in some of the most pressured competitive arenas you could find, and still, you know, the passion for the game, the love for the process is what separates the ones who succeed from the ones who ultimately get burned out, locked up, don't love it. So people will often say, but the tests are the problem. I agree. I mean, the tests are an issue. But in any environment, a teacher can create a love for learning. If you're preparing for any standardized test, you can frame the learning through a passion for accomplishment, through achievement, through making internal progress, for the joy that comes with that crystallization experience or the feeling of learning new things. Or you can have them be afraid of the fact they have a big test, that they prepare for it, they have to memorize things, they should feel afraid of the shame that will come if they do badly. You know, sadly, many teachers just fall into that rut. And I think that we should all think really creatively about how to do this. I see this, frankly, in the larger corporate world. I see consistently cultures that are more or less successful in making this transition from a purely results-oriented culture to one that's based around a thriving love for process. And even in the most bottom-line environments you could possibly have, love for the game is what defines success. So we should all think about this. I mean, and I know it's difficult within certain academic environments, but it all has to start from somewhere. And I think that I mean, it's a huge part of my passion for working in education is to move it towards being about love and not being just about the test.
Thanks.
And subtleties of language. I mean, it's unbelievable the language that we use, the impact that it makes on students or on adults. And often what teachers will do is that they'll work on this material intellectually, but they won't really integrate it into their lives. And so they'll spontaneously come out with something to a student about, you're so smart, you're so brilliant. And they don't realize how damaging that can be relative to their hope, their movement towards being incremental or mastery-oriented in their theory of intelligence. And so really, for a teacher, the first step is for the teachers and the parents to integrate this material not only into their intellectual knowledge but into their fibers. If they believe it, they have to practice it themselves and develop habits themselves around it relative to the language that they use, not only relative to their kids but in their own lives, the internal mm-hmm. language to themselves. And once those changes are organic, then they'll manifest towards the kids. I think people tend to focus a lot on superficial change, which is sort of stuff that you might know intellectually, but you haven't really integrated into your being, into your lifestyle, into your habits, into your kinesthetic intelligence. And that's, again, why we created these guides. And I highly encourage you guys to work with them and to send them to parents. It could be very interesting to choose the sections of the guide that relate to the principles you guys are working with, and they all have exercises. And we can always tweak them somewhat depending on the nuance of your class. And send them to parents so the parents can go through these exercises and reflect on them themselves. So then you have teachers, students, and parents all grappling with the material, not just reading it. And just one last point about this. In chess, for example, if you're trying to make progress as a chess player, and you're going to study the games of a guy like Bobby Fischer, if you go back and you study the World Championship games, say from 1972, his match against Boris Spassky, by playing through the games and reading Fischer's commentary, you'll learn X. If you study that material by spending, if you're a high-level chess player, by spending 3 or 4 hours in each game, or even the same amount of time that you'd spend on reading it, but playing the game as if you were Fischer in that moment, so grappling with decisions like you were playing in a tournament, and if you made the same decision as Fischer, then move on. If you made a different decision, really studying the difference. So you're actually playing those games yourself without looking forward in terms of what he did. You learn 10x or 100x because one of them integrates it deep into the fibers of your being, and one of them is just superficial, external learning. So I think we need to harness this deeper integration of these ideas, and the guides are a great way to do it. My pleasure. Thank you for all your points. They're wonderful. I know we said we were gonna end at 2. It's 1:59. Would anyone like to throw in one last comment before we close?
This is Roberta in Richmond, Virginia.
Hi, Roberta.
Hi. I'd just like to share how I started working with the art of learning. In August of 2011, I was supposed to give a workshop to tutors. I work with tutors, I train tutors, and in my research I came across your name and then the title of the book, and then after I did more research I found out about the foundation. But before that, one of the things we wanted to do was to demonstrate to our tutors how to think mindfully of their quote, inner journey towards learning, and to learn what's required mentally and emotionally in order to achieve, quote, optimal performance, and to figure out a way for them to teach their tutees how to do those things. So the first thing I did with the Art of Learning is I asked them to read, the tutors, to read as much of chapters 1 through 8 as possible, and then asked them to write their own reflective or responsive or reactive narrative, which they would title The Foundation. My only disappointment is that all of the tutors who said they were going to participate did not, but of those who did, they got excellent, I got excellent reactions in terms of they're really searching for their own documentation of their learning and how they came to learn. I haven't sent those in yet, but I just like wanted to share that that's the way we used the book the first time.
Thank you so much, Roberta. That's beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing it. And I, you know, you used a I love how you're having them grapple with the material themselves. And I also used the term mindfully. And maybe it's a beautiful place to close here because I didn't explore this so deeply in these initial guides, but I believe that mindfulness or meditation training is one of the most important, maybe it's one of or the most important habits that one can integrate into one's life if you want to be a really high-level creative being. There's a lot of stigma attached to it. Sometimes people think about meditation and it seems like such an abstract idea. But there's something so profoundly powerful about sitting in stillness. This habit that I described of aiming the mind at an area of complexity or posing a question, releasing the mind from it, maybe going to sleep, taking a nap or the night sleep or workout, and then returning the mind to it and having an output session, a creative burst. It's the kind of thing that can be done around meditation so powerfully, where you focus on complexity, meditate, and then return, release the mind, then return, and see what has gelled. There's something about sitting in that stillness, releasing the mind from cognitive biases, from inertia, from bad habits that might have been accumulating, and you see the world so clearly. Meditation, mindfulness training has been a huge part of my life since I was 18 years old. I see 5-6 years ago there was a lot of resistance to it. Now, I mean, if you look at the greatest performers, for example, in the finance world, they're meditating very deeply. In the sports world, meditation. It's something which is just synonymous with elite performance at this point. And I think it's something which is lacking in school systems. And I think it could be very powerful to consider the idea of even 1 minute teaching students to sit for 30 seconds or a minute after studying complicated material and do a meditation. Just focus on their breath for 30 seconds, 60 seconds, and then return their mind to the material and see how they feel about the material. It's the kind of exercise which, again, is internalized. It's helping deepen this habit of question, release the mind, and then brainstorm, which is at the core of insights everywhere. And it's also building the secondary habit of meditation, the skill of meditation, which is something they can take with them their whole lives. It's when I was coaching chess students, I had a group of kids I wrote about this, so I think you know about it, but I had a group of kids at PS116 in New York City who I began coaching when I was 17 or 18, and I coached them from kindergarten to fifth grade, from moving the pieces to winning city, state, and national championships. And I taught them to meditate. Whenever they made a mistake and they found, their heart rate racing, they were in danger of falling into a downward spiral, momentum turning away from them, they just do a 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 second meditation and return to presence. And young kids can do this, and they can generate so much insight from it and learn to find their center. It's a very interesting habit that you might consider integrating into the study of this material, because so much of what my principles are about is quality over quantity, not the accumulation of more and more and more knowledge, but doing deep work, depth over breadth, doing deep work with what we have or what we've already learned. And meditation is an incredible way to harness that. So, for example, Luke, if you are integrating through your study of structure, the idea of form to leave form, numbers to leave numbers, and you have people doing this journaling process where they're waking up first thing in the morning and journaling on a question they posed, you might consider in the middle of the day in the classroom doing some complex work with them and then taking a 30-second break where they do some kind of simple mindfulness meditation, and then they spend 2-3 minutes journaling or writing about it or thinking about it. It's sort of a micro manifestation of that broader. You talk about making smaller circles. This is the true embodiment of making smaller circles. The large circle being the evening, morning, question, release, brainstorm in the morning. The smaller circle being a microburst of it during the day. Guys who I train in these elite mental performers I talk about, I have them do 3 or 4 or 5 microbursts of this through the day. And this is a very pure expression of this making smaller circles. It's the smaller embodiment of the same broader practice.
Yep, makes sense.
Yeah. Hey, so listen, guys, I thank you so much for joining. I'm really honored that you're working with my material. I love the quality of all the ideas that you brought up. I hope that some of the things that I said were helpful. And please actively engage with the foundation. Katie, again, is just such a great mind, and she and I work very closely. So if you have any questions about how to integrate these things, habits that you might want to work into any kind of curriculum you're grappling with, please email her. She and I will be closely in contact. And we can also periodically have these calls if they'd be useful to you. So thank you again for everything that you do.